Good morning. Great to see everybody here today. We're going to continue our study of Elihu's speech, actually finish it up this morning, and then move into the speeches of God. And I had a chance to talk with Stephen over the last couple of weeks, some of the things he wants emphasized. I'll try to bring those out, especially as we get to the speeches of God. In fact, I think in 2019, he preached a lesson just on the speeches of God. And so I was able to listen to that one, kind of use some of that material, but I won't completely review it. You can listen to it as a good reminder, but we will talk about some of the same things this morning and into the next class period. But as we finish up Elihu's speeches, here we go. What I'll do on the PowerPoint is I'll have the question that Stephen asks in the material up at the top in larger letters, and then I'll have some subpoints that we'll make under that are related to it. So I'll go ahead and ask this question, though. How does Elihu describe God's approach? And then in 38:1, how does God approach?
Comes in thunder and light, riding upon a storm.
All right.
And then, of course, that's very much how we see God approach.
Exactly. Very good. And something I would note about this, and we talked about it briefly on Wednesday night, is that the Bible often pictures God as coming in on a storm, that this is his presence, often when it is connected with judgment of some kind. Some people that I thought of that would follow chronologically, depending on when you date the actual writing of the book of Job, this could have been a reminder to the Israelites of something that happened in their past. But, for instance, Moses in Mount Sinai, you think about the thundering and the lightning, the storm, was a picture of God giving his law, his presence there. And then, of course, as Israel becomes sinful, it's going to be even more ominous that he is in that storm. Or think about Elijah, who God is actually not quite in the storm, that the storm passes by on the same mountain, if you will, but God is just whispering. And I think what is being indicated there is that Baal, who is the god of thunder and lightning, all those things that Baal can do, God's whisper is even stronger than the storm of Baal. And then Ezekiel, remember the vision as he comes in, riding on his chariot, if you will, with the wheel within a wheel. It's pictured as a storm with thunder and lightning and a whirlwind. I put Adam up here as a possibility because there is some discussion as to whether God, after they sinned, it says that God would come in the cool of the day in most translations. There's another way to translate that is he came in the wind of the storm. So is this a judgment scene or is this picturing what he had been doing in kind of a peaceful scene? Either way, you have God, possibly from the very beginning, coming in judgment with a whirlwind and announcing his presence many times with a whirlwind. Now, I'll also point out, have here on the screen, the God of the gaps. Has anyone heard that expression that atheists sometimes use? The God of the gaps is an expression that's used that when people didn't quite understand how things worked naturally, they just said, oh, that's God. And so when there was a storm, oh, that's God. And so the picture here is that the storm is representing the deity. And what we find here is that this is not just Job or whoever's the narrator is writing this down saying, oh, God is the storm. It's saying God is, and he's using a storm to announce his presence. And so there's a bit of a difference there. I don't think we need to get scared whenever atheists say, you know, we're just applying things to God that we don't understand. No, it's we believe there's a God from evidence, and he is using nature to present himself. And I think that's what's happening here in Job. Now, let's read the first part of Job chapter 37 here, all the way through. We read some of it already in our last class, but I want us to read through 1 through 13. It says, at this time also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. Listen closely to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that goes out from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it loose, his light and his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars, he thunders with a majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders with his voice marvelously, doing great things which we do not know. For to the snow, he says, fall on the earth, and to the downpour of rain, and the downpour of rains, be strong. He seals the hand of every man, that all men may know his work, Then the beast goes into its lair and dwells in its den. Out of the south comes the storm, and out of the north the cold. From the breath of God ice is made, and the expanse of the waters is frozen. Also with moisture he loads the thick cloud. He scatters the cloud of his lightning. It changes direction, turning around by his guidance, that it may do whatever he commands it. On the face of the inhabited earth, whether for correction or for his world or for loving kindness, he causes it to happen. Now, there's several things that are stated here, and we've talked a little bit about the storm and how God is going to actually represent himself in a storm. But why does God speak in a storm? Let's get behind it. Why does Elihu say God uses this method? And then why should Job listen? There's some specific verses there that might help with your answer. For correction, yeah. So I think that's part of the big why, of especially why Job needs to listen, is because this is going to be for correction. Can you see any other reasons why Elihu thinks God represents himself in nature in these ways? Very good. Why would he say that? Exactly. Right. So God is using these things that we don't have full knowledge of to show he's bigger than those things. He knows what's going on. He's behind. He's in control. And so he's going to use these things. And I think Stephen mentioned it just in brief last time, or maybe it was one of the sermons that I listened to about Job over this past week from him, is that the idea that people in the ancient times didn't know is false. But even with the knowledge that we've gained in modern times, we still don't understand everything about weather patterns. We still don't understand how God is doing every little thing that happens in nature. There's some things that are going to be beyond us. And that is a message that we need to hear as a modern, prideful culture, that we've got it all figured out and we know exactly how things work. We need to be humble enough to say God's in control of this and he uses it for his purposes, which might include correction, which Job needs to hear. Any other thoughts on that section? All right. Then let's continue on with Elihu's speech here. And let's read verses 14 through 20. Job chapter 37, verses 14 through 20. Give ear to this, O Job. Stand and carefully consider the wondrous deeds of God. Do you know how God establishes them and makes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know about the layers of the thick clouds, the wonders of one perfect in knowledge? You whose garments are hot when the land is quiet because of the south wind, can you with him spread out the skies, strong as a molten mirror? Make us know what we shall say to him. We cannot arrange our case because of darkness. Shall it be recounted to him that I would speak? If a man says a word, will he indeed be swallowed up? All right. So in this section, Elihu asks some rhetorical and sarcastic questions of Job. Who's going to do the same in the very next chapter? God. Now, why do you think Elihu, why do you think God are using some sarcasm and some rhetoric here with Job? Yeah, to make him think. Rhetorical questions are meant to make us think. We're not supposed to have the answer. And he's saying, God has these answers, but you don't have these answers. And so, Job, when you got a little out of step and tried to speak about things you didn't know, you need to take a step back and think about who you're talking to. God is the one who is in control of this. And thus, this shows us that not only in Job, but also in the prophets, sarcasm was a method not to just be demeaning, but to cause thought. And so we'll see that in God's speeches, and then we'll also see it as we continue reading in our Old Testament study as we move into the prophets at times. Any additional thoughts there on that section about some of those questions that Job asked, or were asked of Job? I think there is an element of that. What do you think?
God, you don't know the things God knows,
I think you're right. Any additional thoughts on that? I think that is the tenor of Elihu's words, is you may have been righteous for nothing, Job, but your words got you in a little bit of trouble as you went on in this difficult situation. Any additional thoughts, comments, questions? All right. Something else I would note here in this section is that you have a phrase that we've seen very similar phrases used before, and that is the word perfect. Here it says perfect in knowledge. You see the Hebrew word up there on the screen. It's used three times in the book of Job. I'd like us to look at those three because I think it is somewhat interesting how this word is used. So Job 12 and verse number 4. And as you're turning and looking at that, before I read verse number 4, look at verse number 1. Who's going to be speaking here? Job. Very good. So let's read what Job says in verse 4. I am a laughingstock to my friends, the one who called on God and he answered him. The righteous and blameless man is a laughingstock. I don't know if your translation says anything different besides blameless, but that's the word perfect. A righteous and perfect man is a laughingstock. Now let's go over to chapter 36. And you can look in verse 1 there. Who's going to be speaking here?
Elihu.
Very good. So let's read verse number 4. It says, for truly my words are not a lie. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. All right, we talked about that a little bit in our previous class. Now let's go to chapter 37 and verse number 16. Look at that one more time. Do you know about the layers of the thick clouds, the wonders of one perfect in knowledge? Now, when Job uses the word perfect, who does he say is perfect? He's saying, I am. I am the one who is righteous and blameless. I'm the one who's righteous and perfect. Elihu, in chapter 36, who does he seem to be saying is perfect in knowledge? Himself. He seems to be saying Elihu is perfect in knowledge, and we talked about that, how that doesn't have to be just a prideful statement. It may be that he's just saying, I have a fuller or more complete knowledge than what all of you have had. And then Elihu again, in chapter 37, who does he seem to be saying has perfect knowledge? God. And so we have it applied to Job, we have it applied to Elihu, we have it applied to God. And are any of them wrong in their use of the word perfect? I don't think so. Especially as we're moving farther back, Job is just saying, I'm innocent. I have not done what you claim I am doing. Elihu is saying, I have a perfect knowledge that I can help you a little bit with. And he's saying, why? Because God is the one who is perfect in knowledge. And so I think the lesson to be learned here is, one, this connects Elihu a little bit more with God, but it also helps us to see that Job was connected with God in his behavior and how he lived, thus making the challenge all the more real. Way back at the beginning of the book, is this is Satan would say, does man serve God for nothing? And so the implication is, Job is only perfect because you've given him everything. Job is saying, I am going to hold on to my perfection, onto my righteousness, because I have not done this just to have all the stuff. And you, my friends, are claiming I could just repent and get all that stuff back. He says, I can't repent of what I haven't done. And so this connects both Job and Elihu to God. And thus, when we get to the one who is actually truly perfect in knowledge in chapter 38 and following, we'll see how he approaches all of this, and the approach he uses to say, I am the one who is perfect in knowledge, so think about what you've been saying. All right, any comments or questions, thoughts about that? All right, one just minor side point that I'd use, and I mentioned this to Stephen the other day, and it's somewhat interesting to me that Elihu uses the name Job 9 times. The friends never say Job's name, and only the narrator and God use Job's name outside of that. And God only uses his name, his personal name, at the end of the book. You haven't acted as my servant Job has. You haven't been innocent as my servant Job has. Maybe that suggests a little bit more personal connection between Elihu and Job than the friends in Elihu, or the friends in Job. They're not even willing to say his name. Job is willing to get personal and say some things directly to Job. And in the same way, God is going to uphold Job, both at the beginning and the end of the book, and the narrator uses that name. So it was just kind of an interesting side point to me that as I was reading through, I noticed Elihu's the only of these men who actually use the name of Job. All right, let's go on to finishing up this section here, verses 21 through 24. Says, so now, men, do not see the light, which is bright in the skies, but the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes golden splendor. Around God is fearsome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him, he is exalted in power. And he will not afflict justice and abundant righteousness. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise of heart. And that's going to be how Elihu ends his speech. Now, we've seen this metaphor of darkness and light throughout the book, and we've talked about it at various times. In fact, I looked at all the various forms of the word dark, either darken, darkness, and I think the plural form as well. 38 times in the book of Job. Light is used 28 times in the book of Job. But as we get to Elihu, you can maybe do a little bit of contrast if you want to how Job has used it previously and maybe the friends. But how does Elihu talk about darkness and light? What do you think he's saying here in this last paragraph as it comes to light and darkness? And also in the previous paragraph, it uses the word darkness. Very good. Do you remember how Job had used darkness? Way back when?
Seemed to view it as a, I think he used it somewhat as a synonym for the grave, but he seemed to view it as a place where he might find relief.
Right. So what I find interesting is that Job is saying, I almost wish I could just have the darkness. In fact, I think even the expression literally sometimes he used was the valley of death or the valley of darkness, which sounds an awful lot like Psalm 23. And so you have this picture of, finally, if the darkness can cover me, I'll be free from what I've had to deal with. And the implication seems to be that God will no longer see me because his seeing me is causing me all these problems. So I'll be in the darkness. Elihu is saying, God even knows the darkness. The darkness is, as the psalmist would say, is light to him. God is aware. He's in control of all of this. So therefore, he's going to make an application. Even if God seems distant, what is God never violating? Whether we feel like we're in the darkness or in the light, according to verse 23, what does God never violate or afflict, depending on your translation? Justice and righteousness. God is always right, is what Elihu is saying. Now, the friends of Job, quote-unquote friends, have made that same claim. God is always right. Therefore, Job, you must be wrong. Job has said, I am right. Therefore, I'm having a lot of difficulty with this God always does what is right idea. Elihu comes along and says, you may be righteous in that sense, though you have gotten a little out of line with your words, but God is also always right. And so he's kind of balancing the two extremes, if you will. And I think he is calling Job to consider God can be right and you can still be suffering even though you haven't done what your friends are claiming that you've done. Just make sure that you don't accuse God of injustice with your words or by your implications because of the things that you're going through. I think that's maybe how this is working together. And verse 24, therefore, what is Elihu's application? If God knows the darkness and the light, if he never perverts justice, then what should be man's application of this? Don't become conceited. Fear him. Be respectful and reverent toward God. You agree with Elihu's speeches? I think he's gotten a lot right as we've worked our way through over the last couple of weeks. In fact, let's talk briefly about that. How would you summarize the speeches of Elihu as we've studied them over the last couple of weeks? What do you think Elihu has been trying to say from beginning to end of his speeches? What's your takeaway? All right, there's a reason behind what you might be enduring. Was there another comment? Very good. Any other thoughts?
Because you don't understand doesn't mean God's not right.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And going back to the illustration I gave earlier about atheists accusing us of having a God of the gaps, it's really they who have a gaps type mentality is that they are saying science will eventually get us there. We don't need God. And the idea here is we need to be humble enough to recognize that there has to be something beyond this who is in control of this. I thought I saw another hand start to go up. Did someone have another comment? All right. We've kind of touched on this, but what personal application, personal lesson would you take away from Elihu's speeches? What are you going to do with what Elihu said?
I see this partly back to the first question. Elihu has a tremendous amount of respect and awe of God. I see the friends as just thinking of God as somebody, something that's out there, powerful and he's righteous and all that, but Elihu seemed to have more of a true handle and relationship with God. And he's saying to Job, you have a relationship with God too. Don't mess it up.
Right. Excellent. Excellent. Any other thoughts?
One thing that Elihu is pointing out is consistent with what Jesus taught. Job's friends had judged unrighteously. They had judged righteous.
Excellent. Very good. Any other thoughts?
For Elihu to start out as angry as he was at Job and his friends, it speaks a lot to him to say the things that he said the way that he did, even out of anger.
Excellent. 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 And I think what Elihu does with that kind of an idea and what we on the other side of the New Testament might be able to look at is that God is like that light that's shining in a dark place. And remember that John says that men hate the light because they want to dwell in darkness. We have to learn to love the light. We also have to recognize that sometimes God is going to be that wind who blows everything away. And are we going to have that foundation when the storm comes through, built on Jesus, Matthew chapter 7, that can hold up in the midst of all that? I think these are lessons that we can draw out is God can use all of this, nature, circumstances, in order to try to bring us closer to Him. Not necessarily that He's just judging us as sinners, but He's drawing us closer to Him. Any additional thoughts on that? Right.
Just something Tony said reminded me. He said, don't mess it up. You have a relationship with God. Don't mess it up. How opposite is this? These five, however many chapters it is, Mm-hmm. Right. How long will you hold on to your integrity? Mm-hmm. Curse God, die. Elijah says, you hold on.
Right.
You keep that.
Right. Excellent. All right, we've already kind of covered on that. There's lessons. How can we go about applying that? So let's go on to lesson number 12 in your worksheets, and we're going to be moving into the final section of the book of Job with God's speeches and then the kind of epilogue, if you will, as we look at verses or chapters 38 through 42. And I'll get as far as I can this morning because I know that there's a lot to discuss in chapter 38 proper for Wednesday, and I'm going to be hoping to get through most of 38 and 39 on Wednesday. So I'm going to try to cover as much as I can of these two chapters, the rest of this class and next class. So let's think a little bit about this idea and using the question that Stephen posed to us. To whom is God addressing himself, and does this sound like a rebuke?
Mm-hmm. Out of the whirlwind. And then when he says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. If that's not a rebuke, I don't know.
Exactly. And what's interesting is at the end of Job's last speech, he says, answer me. And then God's going to turn around and say, you answer me. Now, something interesting here that I came across in, he's as liberal as all get out, but he was going through and talking about Job. And what he mentioned that I thought was interesting is that this also demonstrates the power, the sovereignty of God, is that when Job says, God, no one else has been able to answer me, you need to answer me, that God just lets Elihu speak for more chapters than Job or even more than himself to give a pause so that he can almost say, I'm not at your beck and call, Job. And whenever I come, I'm not just going to answer the way you want answered. I'm going to make you answer me, and let's see if we can come to an understanding. So I thought that was an interesting view of Elihu, is not only to prep the way for God, but also to give a little interlude before God actually answers Job when Job has told him he must answer him. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Just a couple of interesting observations I found as we look at this initial section is that only the narrator of Job actually uses the name Yahweh with two exceptions. And I want us to actually look at those two exceptions. Way back in chapter 1, and I'm using the Legacy Standard Bible, and so they actually render the name God as Yahweh. Whenever in your Bible it probably has Lord in all caps to represent the personal name of God. So I'll read it as it is. But in Job 1:21, remember, after all those terrible things had happened in chapter 1, Job says, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. Yahweh gave, and Yahweh has taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh. So Job addresses God with a personal name, or talks about God with his personal name. And then look over in chapter 42. Chapter 42 and verse number 3. Actually, that may not be the verse I was looking for. I may have jotted down the wrong one. Oh, my notes here. 12:9, that's what I was looking for. I was looking at the wrong reference there. 12:9. The name Yahweh is used in chapter 42, but that's again the narrator. Job 12 and verse 9. Who among all these does not know that the hand of Yahweh has done this? And so two times Job uses the personal name of God. The narrator almost always uses the personal name of God. And what we have here is, I think, Job at the beginning is much more, he feels closer to God at that point. And I think he begins to feel more and more distant as he continues to dwell on the things that are happening. But then, whenever we have at the beginning and the end, God speaking and the narrator saying, this is the God of Israel. This is Yahweh. This is the personal God. begin to address Job, it's almost like the narrator is helping us to realize, just as Job felt close to God earlier, now God is going to reestablish that relationship by coming to him as Yahweh. Not just as some unknown God, but as Yahweh coming to him. And he's going to ask some very important questions of Job that will help reestablish that closeness that has maybe been lost a little bit in the course of the book. Also, question here. Who else claims that Job spoke words without knowledge? Remember anybody else who said that? Elihu. Again, notice the connection between Elihu and God. God comes in the whirlwind, just as Elihu said God does. He addresses Job as one who speaks without knowledge, just as Elihu had already done. It's paving the way, getting everyone ready for what God is about to say. We have some other references that you can look at. You can jot them down if you want in 15:2 and contrast that with 42 and verse 3, where you have this picture of the friends also saying God or Job is speaking without knowledge, but they have a much more negative view toward just Job in his trying to defend his own righteousness, which was defensible. Elihu is addressing more just the speeches that Job had given. And then God will come along at the end and say, really, you friends were the ones who spoke without knowledge. You didn't speak like my servant Job did. But what can be claimed for himself? What did Job claim for himself in the earlier speeches? Look back at 13:2. Remember when we studied that? What did Job say about himself toward his friends? What's that?
He was not inferior to his friends.
Very good. I know what you know. So he's saying, I am a man of knowledge. I know what I'm saying as far as if you're on the standard of what the friends know. Elihu has come along and said, but you were saying some things, yes, equal with them, but they didn't know, just as you didn't know certain things. Now God is going to come in and say, Job, you didn't know what you were talking about. So let's have a little thought experiment as we work our way through, is what God is basically saying. Let's ask some questions. Let's have you answer me, and let's see where you are in your knowledge. All right. Any comments or questions about that? All right. And I already kind of addressed this. I'll just put some references on the screen if you want to look them up at some point. But the phrase answer me or inform me means cause me to know, literally, in Hebrew. In this, you have that expression that's used 38:3, 47, 42:4. That's the request that Job has made of God, and now God is going to come in and say, no, you answer me. All right, any questions, comments about that initial section there, verses 1 through 3? All right, then what I would like to move on to is just start in on the next question that Stephen has there and a couple of ideas there. He left it very open for you. Just find as many connections as you can of 38 and 39 to what is used previously. If you're interested in jotting down some things, there might be a few references in here that Stephen has used that I put on the screen, that and then also some that I think I found as well. And then you can add those to your own and we can help each other kind of see as many references as we possibly can. But I'm going to try to give us a little bit of structure by looking at it in sections. So if you have your Bible, let's look at 38:4-7. 38:4-7, let's read that. It says, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you know understanding, who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? Or what were its base? What were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So as we have this first little paragraph, why does Job need to hear about the founding of the earth? He says, Job, I want you to answer me, so let me ask you some questions about the founding of the earth. Why would God do that? Exactly. No one can possibly know what happened at the beginning. apart from revelation from the one who was there. And God was the only one who was there. I think that's an important point even made in Hebrews chapter 11, where have you ever noticed that it talks about how that by faith the fathers received a good testimony? And then just about the very first person of faith that he mentions, by faith we understand that that things were made out of what is not seen. We often think, oh, first person is Abel. Well, first person is us, is we. We are the ones who by faith understand that God has created all things. And God is trying to approach Job in the same way, saying, trust me, I was there at the beginning. If any of you like Chronicles of Narnia, there's a reference to that where Aslan, who represents Jesus, is basically rebukes the witch, saying, don't speak to me of the ancient magic. I was there when it started. And so there's this picture of God is the one who is from eternity to eternity. Look at what Job had said in chapter 9, verses 4 through 6. Wise in heart and mighty in power, who has stiffened his neck against him and been at peace? God is the one who removes the mountains, they know not how. When he overturns them in his anger, the one who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, and then the one who says to the sun not to shine and sets his seal upon the stars. Notice he's saying, God is the destructive power of the creation. God is saying, I was also the one who created those things. I laid the foundation. Look at chapter 15 and verse 7. And you'll notice that I'm underlining the ones that I feel like we could look at. We don't have time to look at all the references as we move our way through. But Job 15:7 says, Eliphaz asked, were you the first man to be born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? This is a question that's been asked of Job before. And Job has somewhat dismissed that, maybe rightfully so, from Eliphaz, who is saying, you don't know anything because you weren't the first. God has the right to say, you don't know everything that you're saying, Job. I was the one who laid the foundation. All right, any additional thoughts on that? Comments, questions? All right, we'll have several sections I want us to go through. In fact, go ahead and answer question number 2. Find as many references as you can if you haven't done that already. I may go ahead and email out the PowerPoint before Sunday, and if you want to look at some of the references that I have suggested and that Stephen has suggested, that may give you some framework to work from as we move forward. Probably going to spend a lot of time in 38 on a Wednesday, and then go as fast as we can through 39, paving the way for Stephen to lead us through chapter 40 on next Sunday.